Hey everybody, welcome again to F This Movie. My name is Patrick Brownlee, and I am joined tonight for a discussion of The World's End by my two oldest drinking buddies, JB.
I'm defibrillated and back to life.
And Adam Risky.
I'm one third of Marmalade Sandwich.
We're going to be talking about The World's End. You can find our website at fthismovie.net. You should follow us on Twitter. We're at fthismovie. You should like us on Facebook if you haven't already. You're crazy. Go to facebook.com/fthismovie. And you should email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. This, sort of the last summer weekend for movies, the last movie weekend of the summer, it turns out, and I theorized this, I think, on last week's show, you could have only gone to the movies this summer, or this weekend, and had a great summer at the movies.
Yes, but I also like the other thing you said. This might have been a couple podcasts ago, that everything we were looking forward to was a disappointment.
Yes.
And everything at the beginning of the summer that we said, meh, turned out to be a terrific surprise.
Yeah.
It's, two of film.
I don't know. I think this weekend is inarguably a bounty like we haven't seen in a long time.
Yeah.
But ever since, say, like late July, I've noticed that it's gotten a little bit better because I'll give you The Conjuring. I thought Drinking Buddies.
Yes. Okay.
There's a bunch of Spectacular Now.
Okay.
You're Next, which I'm sure we'll talk about, and maybe that's a good place to start.
But maybe that...
These are all smaller movies.
Well, what I'm saying is that it just proves what I just said, that we've identified August as this dumping ground.
Yeah.
That August is a trash heap.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of those films turned out to be much better than we thought.
Yeah, that's true.
And I'm not going to be on the summer podcast, so I just want to say this real quick. To all of you people out there who need your Man of Steels and all your stuff like that, you can fucking have it. Like, I'm done. Like, I'm really done with that. Like, if I need to stay home and watch video on demand all the time, and that's it, and, like, you can have the Megaplex, that's fine. I concede.
Very quickly, before we start.
Yes.
This kept tumbling around in my mind. Maybe this is just me because I'm a little older. Have any of you noticed that if you are at home of an evening and you are watching the cable TV, there's a channel guide and you flip through it sometimes when you get bored and you're just sitting down to watch and you're not sitting down to specifically watch something. What infuriates me lately is my thumb is forming a thing, a universal sign of hitting the button. And I'm scrolling through the thing. And now that there are so many bad remakes of classic films, it says The Thing. And I get ready to watch the John. Does that happen to anyone else?
I have that problem with Man of the House. It's always the Tommy Lee Jones one. And I want to watch the one with Jonathan Taylor Thomas. So, yes.
I'm wondering to our listenership, does this happen to anyone else? Because The Thing is the worst.
Because
every time I see it,
But there's a whole bunch of other ones now to know that, like, well, the remake.
None of the movies I want to watch will ever be on cable again.
Or just that, you know, the remake is on a cycle on HBO right now, so there's no way it's the original.
Anyway, I wanted to bring that up.
Yeah. What movies? Go to the movies this weekend. No, nobody did, by the way. Nobody did, because the two big movies that opened this weekend, You're Next and The World's End, both made less than $10 million at the box office. Great job, America! This is why we can't have nice things.
Because it's back to school time and everyone's shopping at Target.
So let's talk about what we've seen lately. Adam, you want to start?
Sure. Well, we all saw Blue Jasmine, so yes. I think that's a good place to start. And I really liked it. I thought it was... I'm not a Cate Blanchett fan myself. I can recognize that she's a good actress, but she always comes across as incredibly... She's like the female Daniel Day-Lewis to me. It's just super mannered and super, like... You can see the wheels turning, but I thought that that really worked for her character this time. Mm-hmm. And I think that Andrew Dice Clay and Bobby Cannavale might be the same person. But they're both great in the movie, and Louis C.K. is great in the movie. And it have you ever seen Another Woman? It's a Woody Allen movie from the late 80s with Jenna Rollins.
Yes.
It reminded me of that because it's all about a woman who kind of has no... self-monitor for how she's coming across to other people. And I thought that it was kind of an interesting bookend to that movie, whereas, like, Crimes and Misdemeanors is with Match Points and things like that. Mm-hmm. So it definitely was proves my theory that Woody Allen is hit and miss overall, but when it comes to his dramas, he's usually just hit, or it usually is something worth watching. So,
one of my favorite
interiors.
Well, I was going to say interiors. I actually like interiors for a number of reasons.
Wrong.
Sorry, family dramas. I don't know what it is about family dramas. One of my favorite scenes of the year so far is in Blue Jasmine. That scene where she's at the diner with the two kids and telling them that story.
Mm-hmm.
Ask my wife. We had a truck to Evanston to see it. My laughter filled the theater. And the scene just keeps going. The problem with Woody Allen is, and God love him, he's made so many films and so many great films. There is no quality control anymore.
Mm-hmm.
There was great Allen, and then there was a long period of bad Allen. But now you have no idea what you're going to get.
Yeah, but at least he keeps up the pace where it's one a year. So even if the last one was no good, the next one might be.
The last one was no good.
Right, and before that was Midnight in Paris, which was really good. And before that was You Will Meet a Tall Dark Stranger, which was no good. And before that was Vicky Cristina Barcelona, which was pretty good. So we're kind of back and forth now.
I thought it was weird because I didn't know that Blue Jasmine was supposed to be a drama. So when I went to see it, I thought it was going to be like a comedy drama, more in line with like Melinda and Melinda or something kind of lighter.
Right.
And then when I found that it was not that there's some parts in it that are funny, but it's always more like acidic, funny, kind of black comedy.
And where humor. We end up at the end of the film.
It's really brave and good.
That's not funny at all.
No.
I had a hard time watching many scenes in Blue Jasmine. I have this thing where I get so uncomfortable that I just want to get up and leave. And so much of the movie did that to me.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought it was really good, and I agree with a lot of what you're saying about Cate Blanchett. I think I tend to maybe like her a little bit more than you. I have a hard time believing that there will be a better performance given this year.
I would agree with that.
I'm scanning my brain.
Not yet.
Right.
Not yet, for sure.
Yeah.
She really seemed to dig in that part, and I think that it really emphasized everything that's good about her as an actress.
Yeah.
It really
kind
of brings it out to the forefront.
Yeah, I thought it was really good. Just a really good actor showcase and a really interesting character study. So I liked it a real lot. What else besides Blue Jasmine?
I saw The Act of Killing at the Music Box.
The movie The Act of Killing.
No. Southport is getting bad
again.
Very
rough neighborhood.
Southport's getting bad again. It involved a brick, but I yelled really loud.
And the guy who owns Cullen's.
Yeah, and the guy who owns Cullen's. Rest in peace. So, I saw The Act of Killing. I was reading reviews for it and op-ed pieces for months about it, saying what a harrowing experience to watch it is and what an amazing documentary it is. And the movie that I read about is not the movie that I saw, because I think that I understand in interviews from the filmmaker Joshua Oppenheimer that he is trying to show that in Thailand, it's basically if Nazi Germany won, and this is what would have happened, comparable to that. And I think that he picks the wrong character to focus the movie around. The movie tries to kind of, it reenacts a lot of the torture scenes that these men took part in. And they ask for these men who were gangsters and executioners, they ask for their participation in order to kind of show what these they were fighting, they were trying to kill off communists and show like what they did to interrogate them and murder them. And the person that he chooses is a person who is probably the weakest in, he kind of just went along. He wasn't, he said, you know, if I didn't do this, then basically like I had no other option. I had to go along. And there's another person who has one of the best introductions I've ever seen in a movie. He comes off a plane, and because he's there to help with this film project, and he's one of the executioners, and he's since gone off and lived somewhere else, but he has a shirt on that just says apathy. And then, like, he is the most evil person that I've ever heard in my life. Just, he says stuff that war crimes are written by the winners of the war, so I'm the one who determines what the war crime is. And it's just so dark and so much more compelling than the main focus, that I thought that was a mistake that the movie couldn't come back from. I also think that the documentary filmmaker maybe had the movie get away from him a little bit, because I think that the gangsters and murderers took advantage of him, and I think that the fantasy sequences are very indulgent, and they lose the point quickly. So,
that's a shame, because it seemed intriguing. I know the filmmaker was on Real Time with Bill Maher, and it sounded like a film I wanted to see.
Yeah. You should still see it, because maybe I just watched Cliffhanger and Last Action Hero, and then I went to see The Act of Killing. I felt like I probably should have appreciated The Act of Killing more than I appreciate Last Action Hero and Cliffhanger, but Cliffhanger holds up.
This was the end of the summer, and I was desperately trying to cram things in before school started again, and my son has gone off to school, and my wife was at this conference, and so I had nothing better to do, so it was movie orgy. We're the Millers is what is wrong with American comedies. Great premise. Nothing's done with it. You can see all the different color script pages where they can't decide on a tone because they want to have this, which is gross, and this, which is completely heartless, and then at the end they want to warm our hearts.
Right.
Well, you took my heart away during the heartless parts, and that was horrible. I attended Beetlefest again, where they premiered a documentary called Good Old Frida, which I'm going to write about in about a week when my column returns. Saw two biopics, Lovelace and Jobs, both of which were awful. Jobs is worse. Lovelace takes the dubious, I don't think this is a spoiler, we see her rise to fame for the first half hour.
I'm sorry, did you do air quotes around fame?
Her dubious fame. Her selective fame. We see her rise to fame for what it was. And that film was groundbreaking in that couples went to theaters to see porn, which had not happened before and wouldn't happen again. That for a half an hour we see this rise, and then the film stops and starts again at the beginning to show us what really happened.
What?
So if we've enjoyed the first half
hour... Is there a record scratch?
Wait a minute.
The movie. Yeah. Like, but here's how it really happened.
If we've enjoyed...
And Tim Curry's blowing everyone.
If we've enjoyed the kind of Boogie Nights vibe that the first half hour has, the next hour punishes us.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand what they were up to, because Linda Lovelace did have this strange career, and then she wrote this book, and the book suggested that this is what was really happening. But a lot of people, because I read the book when I was in college, said, if this is the case, then why is the book written so salaciously? If this is really her telling the truth, why are the stories suspiciously tuned to turn people on?
Okay.
So there was that double bind. Jobs, by far, much worse than Lovelace. The filmmakers have no attitude and no tone and nothing to say about their subject. So the entire film is, this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened. And I was sitting there and it was like, this is like the worst made-for-TV movie I've ever seen.
That's exactly what the trailer promised. I when I saw the trailer, we were laughing because I really felt like if it had shown on Funny or Die, it would have been a brilliant takedown of biopic trailers.
Right. And you had said that The Act of Killing focused on the wrong person. So did Jobs. Because the filmmakers can't even decide. There were many ways in which Steve Jobs was a son of a bitch.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the technical innovations he ushered in have changed the world. So maybe that's a big enough palette for you to do something on. Josh Gad plays Steve Wozniak.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only good performance in the film.
He's usually not good. That surprises me.
No. And it might be the script, but...
He wants to gad all over your face a lot of times.
Well, then this was... I think you've seen Josh Gad in a lot more stuff than I have.
Unfortunately.
But he was very good in this, and... You wish that it had been a movie about Steve Wozniak,
mm-hmm.
because Josh Gad has all the best lines in the film. There's a scene where he talks to Jobs and tells him why he got involved in this before he leaves Apple. Wozniak walked away at one point. It's the only part of the film that has any artistry at all. And finally, In a World, which is slowly making its way out for a wider release. Wonderful indie film, not a trace of indie twee. It's a romantic comedy, but it's also about a lot of other things. It's one of these films that, well, yeah, it can be about five different things. It's a movie. It doesn't have to be just one thing. It's about the world of voiceover artists, but that's not really what it's about. Mm-hmm. It's about family. It's about fathers and daughters. It's got this nice little love story in the middle of it between Lake Bell and Dimitri Martin. It was a big surprise of the summer. And one more thing about Kick-Ass.
Oh, all right.
Because I listened to your podcast.
All right.
And I was eagerly waiting for Kick-Ass 2 because I like Kick-Ass so much. And I loved your podcast, and I thought you put your finger on it. And before you got here tonight, Adam and I were talking. If you watch Kick-Ass, yes, and then you watch Kick-Ass 2, yes, and you cannot see the difference,
yes,
you have no critical faculties. Now, it might be the case that the first one was made by Matthew Vaughn, right?
Yes.
That Matthew Vaughn, his reach, he outreaches his grasp. That he's trying for things that he doesn't completely accomplish. But it's so clear to me what Kick-Ass is trying to do in terms of the dichotomy between comic book fantasy and real violence. In fact, you can even see the entire film is going back and forth. Think of the first thing in the film with the guy at the top of the building. He's making it very explicit. Kick-Ass 2 is demented.
Kick-Ass 2 is like...
it's like fan fiction.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Like a guy who's watched Kick-Ass on YouTube and tried to make his own.
I would say that Kick-Ass is my favorite movie. So my mother bought me a very inexpensive word processor, and I have written the sequel myself. At the end, they kiss.
Sir, who are you? Because that's a great voice, and I want to hear it.
Certain movies.
Well, Adam, I will tell you.
Ooh.
I'm a big fan of movies, and there's something wrong with my mouth.
I like cabaret singing, too.
Certain movies really rub us the wrong way, and a lot of people had that reaction to the first Kick-Ass. I didn't. I liked it. Kick-Ass 2 rubbed me in such the wrong way that when I read reviews, or a lot of times comments under the reviews, where people are like, I don't know, I thought it was about as good as the first one. It was fun. The action was good. They're saying words that... my brain literally cannot compute that they're describing the movie in these ways. And again, you're not wrong to like it, except you're a little bit wrong to like it.
Yeah.
The minute I saw it, this one thing popped into my head. And I think later I talked to you and you had already recorded the podcast. And I thought you said it. I think you said it on the podcast. And I was like, yes, Kick-Ass 2 is the film that everyone accused Kick-Ass of being.
Yes.
Oh, you thought it was this? No, it's not that at all. Here's what that looks like.
Yeah.
Here's what real ugliness looks like. The scene where all the cops get shot.
Awful, right?
It's awful. Like,
but played for laughs,
have,
I think?
Have you lost your faculties?
Yeah.
I got to sneak in one real quick recommendation because I just came from the Megaplex and I saw The Butler.
Okay.
Okay. I like Precious. I did not like The Paperboy. If you don't like Precious, you don't need to bother seeing The Butler. If you liked Precious, you should see The Butler, because it's really fucking good.
Have you seen Shadow Boxer?
I have not seen Shadow Boxer.
Oh my god, see Shadow Boxer.
Okay, that's
literally
Cuba Gooding
Jr.
Next
thing you do.
Wait, seriously?
And Helen Mirren.
But you're honestly recommending it. You're not being ironic.
No, I think he is.
It's a little bit of both. Like, you should definitely see it, but I'm not saying it's good.
By the way, one little anecdote about The Butler. Actually, two little anecdotes about The Butler. Number one, the studio made them put the guy
Lee Daniels, the butler,
right?
Yeah.
For contractual reasons, because there's another version that another studio is working on.
Right.
When I went to see Kick-Ass 2, it was like when they show it the Thursday night before it opens, and there was a whole mess of people there to see The Butler. And they were wandering around like sheep because they couldn't figure out what theater they were supposed to be in. Here's an idea. It's printed on your ticket. But they were like little old ladies wandering around because the marquee over the door said, Lee Daniels, the butt. Because it gets cut off.
They couldn't.
And I actually
connect those dots.
Well, that's the end credit sequence is Lee Daniels, the butt.
I actually explained to them.
Shadowboxing.
Okay.
I said the full title is this, and that's the theater you want, and you should go in there. And the second thing is they published an article on Slate, like they often do, where they say, is this true? they did that for jobs. How much of this is bullshit? apparently half of the Butler never happened.
They do a lot of...
The son who joins the Black Panthers?
Well, they try to cover the entire civil rights movement through two characters.
He doesn't exist.
Well, that's awesome. I feel great about that. but what I was going to say is, as a movie, I'll judge it later because I don't know all the facts of what's true and what's not true, but as a movie, it's very passionately told. And I'll take that, even if it's messy, I'll take that over something that's just kind of wan and indifferent. And it's... I don't mean to be like Captain Liberal, but I get such a good feeling when a black filmmaker tells a black story, unlike 42, where it's written and directed by a white filmmaker who could have an idea of what's going on, but I don't think that he can have like a deep ingrained feeling of what's going on.
But that being said, it made me wonder, and I haven't seen it yet, if that's why they had the white stunt casting for the president.
Oh, I was calling it Madame Tussauds the Butler also, because the stunt casting is a little jarring. Some are better than others. I was really worried about Robin Williams as Eisenhower because he does that whole like black man voice in his stand-up thing. So I just thought he'd be like, yo, man, what's up? You want civil rights? Like, I thought he was going to do that, but like he's in like one scene and he's out and that's it.
Of all the white presidential cameos in The Butler, which one would you say is the best?
Of the acting, I would probably say Lyndon Johnson. It's just Liev Schreiber, because he seems to kind of want to boil down the man in 2 seconds, and he's really good because you're not watching an actor playing a part. He's just like, this is the personality, and this is it. James Marsden is decent as Kennedy, but...
Era.
But yeah, Minka Kelly makes a really hot Jackie Onassis. Yes. Good for her.
Speaking of celebrity cameos, before we go on to The World's End, James Franco plays Hugh Hefner in Love Life. And this is actually a story that's been told a lot in terms of the night he met Linda Lovelace.
Did he bring his own robe?
Here's the thing. Maybe it was last minute or something, and he agreed to lend his star power. No attempt is made to make him look like Hugh Hefner. Hugh Hefner is well known. I mean, the two of you right now could do a Hugh Hefner impression. Here's an idea. Give him a pipe. Maybe that would be a start.
I was just going to shit my pants. Is that... But I was going to do that anyway.
No attempt at makeup. No real attempt at costume, really. And he doesn't make any attempt to act like it's the most bizarre thing I've ever seen. Because in the same film... Hank Azaria bends over backwards to look like Gerard Damiano, a guy nobody knows. He's been lost to history. And yet Hugh Hefner, one of the most recognizable... No, I'm just James Franco.
I like how you know that he bent over backwards to be Gerard Damiano.
There's one movie I want to talk about. There's some stuff I saw that I'm not going to talk about. But we forgot to talk about Your Next, which came out this weekend.
You saw it twice.
I did. I've seen it twice. I wrote a review last week urging everyone to go and making it a big hit because I don't know if you know this. And
We're the Millers number two.
I mean, not in January, Texas Chainsaw 3D opened to over $20 million. And in its first weekend, made more money than I'll bet Your Next makes in its entire theatrical run. It came in seventh place. It made around $7 million. Nobody went to see this goddamn movie. And it's so good, and you should all be ashamed of yourselves.
And Patrick's been saying this for years. This junk comes out, makes a mint, and then something comes out that's actually worth your time by someone who's trying to do something with the genre, and people stay away in droves. But I have a theory for Your Next relative failure.
Okay.
I think I mentioned this on a podcast at the beginning of the summer, or in May. My students were so excited to see The Purge because of the concept.
Yes.
Could it be that everyone got excited to see The Purge? Everyone went. The Purge made a lot of money. They were disappointed because the movie wasn't very good, and that turned them off going to see another home invasion movie. People were like, oh, well, I saw that at the beginning of the summer.
Go ahead. I was just going to say, I thought that too. I think that, unfortunately, and Your Next came before The Purge because it was made 2 years ago and it was just on the festival circuit for a while. But yeah, The Purge is terrible. And like from the ads for Your Next, because they're doing you a service of not spoiling what is going to happen, it has to live on, this is a home invasion thriller.
Exactly.
But it's not just that. It's very clever. There's action, there's thriller, there's horror. It
turns into something else.
It's great, and I wouldn't dare spoil it. And I don't want to I think our community of fans, I think they're the types that will adopt or like embrace a movie like You're Next. And
yes.
I won't blame them as the massive general audience like I blame, like, Saul and Bradley Lang as the worldwide box office. You heard me. But I think that, like, what I'd like to say to American movie audiences is, fuck you, we'll keep it to ourselves. If we want to be those snotty, like, rock nerds where it's just like, we liked them better when they weren't mainstream, that's fine, because I'll do that with Your Next. I loved it.
But my concern is that now somebody doesn't give Adam Wingard even $5 million to make another movie because his first one didn't make anything.
One thing I'd argue, though, is I don't think he needs it, because Wingard, I want to see them be successful, yes, because they're very talented.
Yes.
But Adam Wingard, Amy Simons,
yeah, I know they all sort of operate.
Joe Swanberg, Ty West, they're going to keep making movies whether people pay money to see them or not. If these movies have to go the way of video on demand and make their mint there and not do it in theaters, then that's fine, because they're doing some of the most exciting stuff in movies right now.
That's what's probably going to happen. And driving away from Your Next this morning, I brought up Office Space, that it sometimes lately seems like if something's really good, people don't get it until they've seen it multiple times on home video or on demand or something. And that down the road, people will recognize this. And obviously, the film owes a little bit to Night of the Living Dead. And remember, Night of the Living Dead was in remission for a really long time. There were people who saw it at a drive-in and remembered loving it. And then slowly, mostly because it slipped into the public domain, it came back. I'm beginning to think that any film that's truly great, Wizard of Oz, it's so great, people can't wrap their heads around it when it first came out. Because in its original release, Wizard of Oz was disappointing at the box office.
Right. And the only issue I have with that, because I agree with you, and, you know, if Drinking Buddies plays on demand, that's fine. And that's how I can see that movie, and I'm thankful for the ability to see it. My only disappointment is something like Your Next deserves to be seen with a big audience. More than a lot of other movies I saw this year. That's a really great audience movie, and to watch it by yourself at home isn't quite the same.
I see what you're saying. I thought that I kind of had a different reaction, though, because I saw it the first time with you in the Flashback Weekend horror convention audience, and it felt more like a Music Box Massacre type movie, where, like, yeah, you get the good audience participation. I didn't realize how darkly comedic, I didn't give it enough credit for as darkly comedic as it was the first time, as I did the second time when I saw it, or just how scary it was the second time, because I saw it in a theater. It was a massive theater it was playing in, and there was about 10 people there.
I think yesterday you were in the same theater we were in.
Possibly.
This morning. It's in 15 and 17.
Yeah, I was in 15.
And
yeah,
so were we this morning.
And it got no laughs, and I couldn't believe, even though it was 10 people, I couldn't believe nobody was laughing.
Yeah, me and the person I went with were the only ones laughing. But I mean, like, because it seemed more intimate, I guess, for lack of a better word, it felt scarier to me than it did the first time.
Yeah.
Again, folks listening to this, I have seen a lot of horror films. This is terrific. You really need to seek it out. It's great.
Yes. All right, let's move on to The World's End, one of the movies I was most excited about this summer, not because of the marketing, but because it's Edgar Wright.
And once again, folks, let's pull back the curtain of F this movie. All three of us saw it separately.
Yes.
None of us know what the other guy thought.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Go ahead and start.
You begin.
Nope.
Well, this is awkward. Marmalade Silence. Sandwich.
Go ahead.
I'll start then.
Yeah, that's fine.
Because fuck you guys. I've seen it twice now, because the first time I saw it, I felt like I didn't like it enough.
Okay.
I liked it, but I liked it less than Shaun of the Dead, and I liked it less than Hot Fuzz. Okay. I wasn't ready to deal with what it was dropping on me. It took me overnight to think about it some more. And then I thought to myself, I think this movie's a lot braver than I'm giving it credit for, and I think there's a lot more to it. So I went back and saw it again, and it's a masterpiece. It really is. I think that you mentioned very interestingly in the Hard Day's Night podcast, I think we're the Beatles were able to write songs on a napkin, and it's like, you don't try to understand genius. I think Edgar Wright is kind of approaching that genius level of filmmaking, because he finds a way of making the technical aspects of a movie work comedically, like just editing and like whip pans, and everything's deliberate and detailed, and there's foreshadowing all over the place.
A lot of thought went into this film.
It's a really, really good movie.
And yeah. I agree with that. It's a really, really good movie. But my reaction is your first reaction. And I thought part of it was, this film, in my mind and what I frequent, had been, the shit had been hyped out of this film.
Sure.
Dana Stevens reviewed it on Slate and said that it was better than Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz, and that it was their masterpiece. So I think part of the problem is I went in with too high expectations. I like it. I was thoroughly entertained. I love what it's trying to say, but I don't love it. I don't think it's as good as Shaun of the Dead or Hot Fuzz.
And I don't
even
think
though
so
the
either.
Message, even though the message, like you said, I give them so much credit for ambition. The message of this film is so twisted and yet so humanistic. Yep. It's like, oh, that's anyway.
And that may be, you know, I don't know that any of their movies have been huge hits, especially in America, and I think part of the takeaway from the movie is going to damn it to cult status more than anything because of the message. And we'll try, we're only going to talk spoiler free for a couple of minutes, because I think to talk about the movie, you have to be able to spoil it. And even part of that is, you know, even the trailers kind of give away the second half of the movie, but I would prefer not to as best we can. I think I lean closer to Adam. It's hard with a director like Edgar Wright, and the same thing happens when I go see a Tarantino movie or whatever, is that my expectations are so high because I like this filmmaker so much that I expect every single movie to be a home run. And walking out of even Django Unchained, I was like, well, I liked that, but I'm not sure it's one of his best. But the more times I've seen it, the more I've liked it.
But then I went back to see it when they showed it at night for that cheap
it's
night
unbelievable.
Thing. Mm-hmm. Right. So the problem is I might have to see it again, because clearly I've seen Shaun of the Dead.
It felt
Hot
like
Fuzz
two different movies,
multiple
honestly.
Times.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm glad you're saying that. Yeah. And I don't think we're in spoilers yet. It is two different movies. And one of my problems was, I was so enjoying the first 45 minutes.
Yeah.
Because, remember, I'm a little older than you two guys. Mm-hmm. That whole thing about trying to go back and recapturing your childhood and how sad that really is, I was so taken with that, that when we get to the twist, I thought, does the film need this? Ultimately, it does for the message at the end. But I thought, if you had really just continued along these lines, you'd have this small little indie film that had no chance at wide distribution. But if you want to get in 3,000 theaters, you need kung fu fights with robots and blue liquid flying around.
But I don't even think I don't agree that it's two different movies, because I think Edgar Wright is good enough that he, obviously one of his interests as a filmmaker is to do genre stuff. That's clearly what he loves.
Yes.
And so I like the way that all of his movies, I think, have married genre stuff with genuine human thematic
right. Without
concerns.
Being overt parodies, he sort of enters the genre from the side.
Yes. And I think this movie, more so than the other two, is more about the human stuff than it is about the genre stuff, because Shaun of the Dead is very much not a parody of zombie movies, because it's also a great zombie movie, but it's about sort of zombie movies, and Hot Fuzz is very much about cop movies, you know. And this movie, I think, is about these characters. I don't think it's about the genre stuff.
But as Edgar Wright and Simon Pegg even said, and this might have been from your report about the Music Box, what the three films are really about, I think, is friendship.
Yes.
Yeah, I think so. And just to clarify, when I said it's two different movies, I didn't finish my thought. I should have been more forceful. I'm sorry. Get down. So, no. The movie I saw the first time I saw it is a different movie than I saw the second time I saw it. The second time I saw it, once you're informed by the eventual endgame of it, it becomes a much richer, better movie, less perplexing.
Their screenplays are unbelievably tight.
It's very dense. It reminds me of, like, sometimes I'll be watching Community and there'll be, like, a scene that's so packed with jokes that I have to rewind it and watch it again. And that's how I feel an Edgar Wright movie is. They're just super dense.
Just the way that... We'll get into spoilers very soon, but the way that this idea of selective memory starts out as a joke about the Simon Pegg character, and it keeps repeating itself until by the end, it's a big part of what the movie is about, and it starts off as this throwaway dig at the Simon Pegg character, and it builds to what we've been talking about this whole time. I'm amazed, and I rewatched both Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz leading up to this, and their screenplays, I think, are amazing.
Also, the running joke that you can't argue with the Simon Pegg character, which has one of the greatest payoffs, I think, in movie history, even though it's not. Before we go to spoilers, one other observation that I really wound up liking this. If you look at the characters that Pegg and Frost play in the first two films, in this one they've switched. That it's very much like John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd in Neighbors. Someone, I'm guessing, Pegg, because Gary King is really, I mean, that's such a showcase part, that given the characters they're used to playing, you could easily see them having done the opposite.
Yeah, this movie really made me realize how good of an actor Simon Pegg is.
Yeah, because, I was going to say the exact
because
same thing.
You always just kind of take it for granted just because he's super funny. But Edgar Wright seems to be able to tap into something that other directors see him as. He's the guy from Shaun of the Dead. He's playing Simon Pegg in our movie.
Right.
But Edgar Wright, if you compare Shaun to Nicholas Angel to Gary in The World's End, very, very different characters.
The comparison I kept making all through World's End is, think about Nick Angel and Gary. Good Lord.
Right. Yeah. A big range.
You show those two films to actors, and you say that's what we mean when we say the actor has range.
Yeah, but you're absolutely right that everybody casts him as the Simon Pegg part. He's always just the wacky sort of comic relief.
Yeah.
And I thought the exact same thing, especially watching all three sort of in a row, was that he's really, really good. And he's given, obviously, great material in this movie that he wrote for himself, but... he's really, really good. And that, you know, that's another one of the movie's charms, is that everybody in the movie is actually really good. Mm-hmm. This is now the second consecutive movie that sort of made me like Rosamund Pike.
What, Jack Reacher
being the first. Yeah. I was like, well, she's not the worst. And I had that same thought this time.
I thought in the role she played,
she
functioned really well. And especially because of her physical type, I thought that worked for a number of reasons.
She's very layered, clothing-wise.
That's true. Hold on. There was one other thing I wanted to say before we go to spoilers.
Okay.
That some of the things this film is saying are so against the grain of the modern zeitgeist that are so, for lack of a better term, because this really reduces it, politically incorrect.
There's one line specifically that I'm thinking of.
I'm gonna take a chance here
because
on a very old podcast, I suggested a different ending for a movie, and I was then made fun of for about 2.5 years.
Is this the Cyrus thing?
Yeah,
twisted fuck.
What an idiot I am! But it is so. When you're watching this, you're like, "There's no way that this could be presented as this." Again, I'm not spoiling anything. That I honestly thought, please note this isn't a spoiler because this isn't how the film ends, that with all the robot stuff, I thought the whole thing was going to wind up being Gary King's dream before he commits to actually going through AA, because when we get to the last couple pubs, the film, by the way, is about a group of old friends trying to recreate a pub crawl from their past. They have to go to 12 pubs on the Golden Mile and drink 12 pints. And I don't drink beer, but that seems like it would be difficult at best. That at the end, when you see the mania that he goes through, because clearly he's an alcoholic and he's doing it for the beer, that's the point I thought the film was going to make, which would be this reductive, stupid, ridiculous, yeah. obvious American movie point.
Yeah.
Look where he got to. And the biggest thing that I applaud the film for is that at the end of the film, they turn that on its head and they say, can we get into spoilers?
Well, before we get into spoilers, I just wanted to say something really quick because I want to get your opinions on it. I think this movie, while is a, to me, it's a great movie, I think it's less funny than Hot Fuzz and less funny than Shaun of the Dead. Sure. I could see myself wanting to go back to those two movies more than going back to The World's End.
But it seems less interested in being as jokey.
But the here's the reason. I do agree with you on that. I want to get back to that. But the thing is, I think there's too many straight men in this movie. Because Simon Pegg is the only kind of wild and crazy one. And everybody else is just kind of like reacting off of him as a straight man.
It made me wonder why they made the decision to have five.
Yeah, I don't know. But it's just like there's more because for him in a to weird kind way, of bounce of off them, of in the two other two of them movies. Are
interchangeable.
Of
the five Musketeers.
Which two are you talking about?
That you could easily... what's the word? You could take the two guys and write it as one guy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Either the contractor and the real estate guy or the contractor and the car salesman.
Yeah, I would disagree. I don't know why there has to be five. A little bit, but I guess let's get into spoilers. I'll just say before anybody tunes out, because you haven't seen it yet, I go into movies like this very cautiously, and I kind of alluded to this on last week's podcast, that when it's a director that I really like, I have to sort of prepare myself, like, this might be the one where they fuck it up. And I really, really loved the movie, and that's not just... internet fanboy talking, because I've already heard backlash about that. Well, people like this movie because the internet says this is the movie that you like, and that's not fair. We like what we like. So I think it's great, and everybody should go see it. Let's talk about spoilers.
And let me make this clear.
Not spoilers yet.
I didn't think it was great,
yeah.
but I think it's very good.
Yeah.
That being said, it's better than 90%
sure.
of the other stuff that's masquerading as art in theaters right now.
Yeah. Just not your next. See your next first.
No. Wait, that's confusing. I think it's very difficult to compare those two films. See your
next first and World's End next.
Yes.
Got it.
What about my neck?
You don't need to get it. Move on.
Okay. That maybe I just need to see it again.
I think it would improve.
Yeah, it improved the second time for sure. Yeah.
That the message at the end of this film is... so wonderful, but so anti everything that we're sort of. Also, had a big problem with the big metal thing. That one thing, there seems to be this modern art statue in the old town where they grew up.
Yeah.
And it turns out to be this sentient monitor robot that searches out. It almost seemed to me like that's the one studio note. Like, a lot of movies that make a lot of money have a robot at the end that fights.
It was kind of like out of nowhere a bit. Well,
listen, if you want to go, and I'm not saying that the movie deserves this much credit, but the point that the movie is making, that everything has become homogenized
yes.
and same, well, that speaks to the exact point that you're making. Here's your giant fucking robot, idiots, like in every movie. I think there's something to be said for that, because one of the things I noticed was that rewatching all the movies, not only are all three movies about friendship, they're very much about conformity.
Yes.
Yeah. Shaun of the Dead, obviously the zombie being a very obvious metaphor for mm-hmm. conformity, that Hot Fuzz is all about. We want everyone that in the town to be...
there's this neighborhood association that's so obsessed with being the nicest town
right.
that they'll murder people.
Right, and that we'd all need to be on the same page, and that this movie obviously is about turning people into the same thing, and... the extent to which this movie kind of says, fuck that, is amazing.
I loved how all the pubs.
Yeah, it was great.
And again, like you said, how much time and attention Edgar Wright lays on small details. The way that's revealed in terms of the shot choice and yeah. the production design
yep.
was very clever. They have all these pubs they remember from when they were teenagers, and apparently, well... we think they've all been bought out by chains, but later we find out it's something far more insidious.
Well, one thing I think that's really interesting, too, is I think the ending is a really bitter pill to swallow, because The movie has that momentary fist pump moment where you're just like, yeah, I don't want to conform. I don't want to be like everybody else. I want, even if it means saying fuck you to everybody else, to like 99.9% of the population, I'm going to do what makes me feel happy.
And the film is saying, like it or not, that's what makes us special.
Yeah.
That we're so goddamn contrary.
But they have a lot of fun with the word robot and the definition of robot, mm-hmm. because does robot mean slave? And a lot, and all of the quote-unquote robots in the movie are saying, we're not robots because we're in charge. We're not slaves. You're slaves. And Simon Pegg's character sees his friends as slaves because they've sold out to corporate America and they're not the people that they were 20 years ago while
he still
is. Whereas
he is exactly.
While he still exactly is. But in the epilogue in the movie, it shows you, and I don't know, even though we're in spoilers, I don't know, do you want me to just
sure,
jump in?
Sure, we can
in?
Jump, because okay. I think actually that's going to be sort of the most controversial thing about the movie is that the last 5 minutes.
So you get that fist pump moment where Simon Pegg very funnel cake. He very humorously says to the network, to fuck off, go back to Legoland, you cunt. And it's awesome. But then, then the network says, you know, fuck it. And you think that they're just like, all right, I give up. But what they really mean is, fine, all this technology stuff that we gave you, it's gone.
Right.
You're left to your own devices completely.
It returns us to the Middle Ages.
It returns you to the Middle Ages. If this is what you want, fine. And it's a really bitter pill to swallow because it's basically saying, say, you know, me, Adam Risky, is saying, you know, fuck you to, like, corporate America, and I just want to kind of do whatever I want. It's like saying, great, but we're never going to ever help you again.
Right.
Like, if you ever need anything that we've ever given you, then fuck you. You said fuck you to us, and that's it.
Which makes the very, very end of the film doubly ironic because Gary has reached a point of happiness, and yet it's with the robots mimetically acting out this fantasy of when he was younger, that he's the leader of this roaming band that goes from bar to bar.
Yes.
And it's presented as triumphant. I mean, at the end he says, I'm Gary, king
of... I'm the king, yeah, right.
King, mm-hmm. And doesn't he say, I'm Gary, king of the humans?
No, he just says, I'm the king, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
I'm the king, because mm-hmm. I thought it was ironic, because clearly because of their light bulb eyes, he's leading a pack of five robots.
Right, and I know some people have taken issue with that, because it's like, well, then he hasn't grown at all. But A, that's bullshit, because he clearly orders a water, so he's not sort of a slave to alcohol anymore. Yes, he's living out, reliving sort of his fun with his friends, but at the same time, because the movie is so anti-conformity, one of the things that I really liked is, now in a world where the blanks are the enemy, he says, no, fuck you, they're my friends. And he's ever the non-conformist, and I think
like
that's
the,
great.
I like the shout-out to Nick Frost's speech earlier in the film where he talks about it truly takes balls after a football game to walk into a pub and order water. I have a question for you two gentlemen.
Sure.
Not that I mean to nitpick the film. Clearly, Gary King is shown to be an irredeemable alcoholic for most of the film. And it's suggested that the Nick Frost character was similarly involved until there was this horrible car accident where the Nick Frost character almost dies. They don't speak to each other for a number of reasons. And Nick Frost has been sober for a really long time. Maybe it just escaped me. When the shit hits the fan, why does Nick Frost immediately start drinking again? That was very strange to me.
Because,
He has nothing else to lose? That part of what he was saying is a lie? Because it's revealed that his...
Yeah, it's just a reaction to, oh, everything I know to be true is false.
And also, that did happen right after they had that melee in the bathroom.
Oh, exactly.
Right. So, yeah, it's kind
it's
of
definitely
like,
fuck it.
Yeah,
yeah, it's kind of... Yeah, I always read it as, you know, like, if something really weird or shitty happens, like, you go to, like, I gotta get a drink. That's
it
just
is
like,
a crutch, it's never presented as not being a crutch in the movie, and yet, to what you were saying earlier about, you know, the dark places that this movie goes, to have Simon Pegg, who is, you know, the hero of the movie, to the point where The movie sees through the fact that he's the hero and burns the world down to his image. The world is brought down to Gary King's level, and he's the king now. Mm-hmm. To have him say, "I don't want to be sober," is really dark, because it's not this cry for help the way it would be in another movie right before he necessarily gets sober. He's telling the truth. Plus, doesn't want to sober up.
It's the truth, because it's his reaction against what reality is. My question is, and I think I know the answer, but I'm interested to hear what you two think. Don't you think the filmmakers are saying, for all the medieval Middle Ages hideousness, that at the end of the film, the human race is better off?
I don't know. I don't know if that's what it's saying.
Clearly, it's two very extreme choices.
Yeah.
Because another moment in the film I loved was when the network explains, well, a couple of people had to be replaced. And as they explore that argument, it turns out the entire town has been replaced except for this old man who hides. And what does he call the other two? It's really funny.
I don't remember.
The two weasels.
Yeah. From the bar. I don't remember.
And the two weasels are really angry when Gary screws, "This was great."
You know, one thing that I thought was kind of interesting was, I wonder if in the last scene where they're in the World's End before they interface with the network, when Gary and the Nick Frost character are having their heart-to-heart, if Nick Frost didn't say that this conformity life is kind of a mirage and it's just as much bullshit as anything else and it doesn't always work out to your satisfaction, because that's what, you know, that's almost like what Simon Pegg wanted, sort of, but like, he feels like he was lied to, like he was supposed to have that, but he can't have that. And once he finds out what he was supposed to have is fucked up too. Mm-hmm. I think if Nick Frost's character didn't say that to him, then when he was given the option of becoming young again, he might have actually chosen to become young again.
But I also think it speaks, we were talking earlier about how cleverly this is written, that if this life that the Nick Frost character has is this lie and this sham, and it's very specific that his wife and children left him because he wasn't present.
Yep.
That's the actual line. Say what you want about Gary. He exists in the moment. He is present.
The spectacular now, if you will.
For what's going on. Yeah. And again, the message we come to at the end of the film, it's so audacious. Mm-hmm. I think that was my favorite part of the film. I think what kept me from enjoying the middle part is I was so enjoying this idea of how sad and odd it is to try to go back, because you can't go back, that the kung fu fights with the robots was breaking up a party I was really enjoying, because I was getting so much out of the first 45 minutes.
See, and I think it just kept the party going in a different way, because now it's an awesome party with great kung fu fights and robots, and I think the camaraderie was still there, and I think a lot of that sadness was still there, and I got such a fucking kick out of how well the five actors play steadily getting more and more drunk. It's amazing how well they do that.
And I love the fights. The fights are very well choreographed. I mean,
the one in the bathroom, that's the fake one take, you know?
That's the one I'm thinking of. Oh my gosh. Dana Stevens thought the fights were all too much the same. I disagree. But one of my favorite moments in the entire film is the meek guy goes and hides in the stall. Mm-hmm. And at one point, the fight comes to him. And as they break down the door, you hear him sort of squeal.
Someone's in here.
Yeah. That's terrific.
And again, all the fights come out of character, that everyone fights in their own character, which is great.
It's a couple of points that you brought up. The first time I saw the movie, and I'm wondering if you'll change your mind after seeing it again, but I had the exact same reaction to you the first time, where I progressively was getting less interested up until the ending of where the movie was going, where I'm just like, I knew that I wanted to see Simon Pegg and Nick Frost, but like, I would definitely see a movie about these five guys as teenagers going on this pub crawl. I want to see the movie about these five guys older going on this pub crawl. When it gets to robots, I wrote it off as like, I'm not that big of a science fiction fan compared to cop movies or horror movies, so I'm a little less interested in what's going on here. But, I kind of lean more towards you, Patrick, on the second viewing, where it just seems like It's like just continuously unfolding. It's fresh and new every 10 minutes because you're being consistently surprised.
It's almost like a Bollywood film where, well, it's dramatic for a while, and then it becomes a hilarious comedy for half an hour, and then a musical number. And why not? Because it's an evening's entertainment. Mm. I thought, and certainly they're not looking at box office or commercial, I mean, how commercial a project is. But you have to admit that because of the action comedy element of it, it supposedly has a bigger audience than just the first 45 minutes. Now, whether this weekend proves that neither is true, I don't know. As the film went on, I began to see the purpose of the robots in terms of the point they were trying to make at the end about being human. Right. And I think that is so great that I'll put up with the robots. I did think the first robot fight was better than all the other ones.
Sure. The first one is really a showstopper.
It's a tour de force.
It is. It's something.
It's weird because I didn't like the fights as much as you guys did. The fight I liked more than the bathroom fight was the one in the one bar where Simon Pegg is just trying to finish the beer. And like it's like something out of like an old screwball silent movie where it's a lot of prop comedy. And he just can't finish the beer because it's always getting knocked out of his hand and things like that.
And again, that's one of those great things about Edgar Wright, to what you were saying sort of at the beginning, is that the movies are, you can see all of his influences, and yet it's not just a series of references necessarily. Right. I mean, his movies certainly are referential at times, but that he's absorbed them into something that it's not just, let's check this out.
That it's his twisted version. It's like a band doing a cover song. Mm-hmm. You have to bring something to it that's different, or else it's just karaoke. That Shaun of the Dead is his twisted version of Night of the Living Dead, and Hot Fuzz is his version of every bad action movie. This is his invasion of the body snatchers.
I mean, there's certainly,
I mean, really
every time with the pointing and the really opening of the mouth.
References.
And,
where was this going?
Well, I was going to mention that with the fighting, I was a little let down by some of the fights just because, coming off of Scott Pilgrim, I thought that the fights kind of had a little bit more spatial sense, where I felt...
he set the bar
He set it so high, I thought it was just a little bit, and this is just more my bias, but like it was a little too close. I wanted a little bit more breathing room so I could see kind of what was going on. But these guys aren't really, you know, they're comedians more than fighters, so...
And yet Nick Frost... proving to be a surprisingly
good Nick Frost
good
surprises the shit out of me all the time. Like, it's like, oh, he's a genius. Oh, he's super genius. Like, he just gets better and better.
But I also thought that the film set up that these robots have some very obvious, excuse me, weaknesses and flaws so that it would be plausible that these gentlemen could be super robot
fighters.
They're
not particularly well built.
Right.
Yeah. You know, the Simon Pegg character seems to be the one that everybody points to as saying, well, he wants to get back to the past, or he's stuck in the past. One of the things I liked about the movie is the way that it slowly reveals that all five of these guys are defined by their past.
Yes.
And that their lives have been lived in a reaction to their past. And the only one I think it doesn't work as well with is Martin Freeman, who's, you know, had the scar removed and is still living in reaction to being called Oman. And I think that's only because he gets turned more quickly than anybody else. And so we don't see, you know, with Eddie Marson, it ends up being his downfall that he has to go back and beat up the bully.
And I actually had a problem with that because his speech about what that guy made his life is so well written and so well delivered and so moving.
Yeah.
That I thought him going nuts and beating the guy and beating the guy and beating the guy, I didn't think that was an adequate payoff for how wonderful that speech was.
I would agree with that. And
that becomes plot. He has to do this so that this can happen.
But I think part of that, too, is that it is suggesting that he is still kind of stuck in that moment. And and as a fan of the movie, maybe I'm making an excuse. He's also way drunker.
I was just about to mention that, too. Yeah. I think that's when you were mentioning, you know, how well the acting is at being drunk later in the movie. That is what drunk people do. Like, when you're super drunk and you see somebody and you're just like, I just want to fucking rip his throat out. You're more likely to fucking rip his throat out when you're loaded than you are when you're sober.
One of my favorite moments in the film, and I had lots of them, is when Gary's in the bathroom going on and on and on. This is right before the fight. Mm-hmm. To that one teenager who couldn't care less. And it's just so sad that he's telling this tale. But I love when Simon Pegg looks at the tile that someone's punched out and says, I did that.
Well, I don't blame the robot teenager for not talking to him, because when you're at a urinal, you don't fucking talk to other people. That's just a rule.
You don't break the code. That's not even a movie lesson. Thought. Some reviewer wrote this, some commenter, I don't know. Someone somewhere pointed out that Eddie Marson seems to be, if you watch his performance, he's the one who's sort of enjoying the whole thing, that he's the one who's actually increasingly having more fun throughout the night.
Yeah, that person's correct. I noticed that the second time. Absolutely.
Very funny. Yeah. He kind of stole the movie. I mean, Simon Pegg is great and Nick Frost is very enjoyable, but Eddie Marson, to me, kind of stole the movie.
And Eddie Marsden is the card salesman.
Correct.
Okay. Yeah.
Phil, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or Peter.
Peter. That's Pete. Right. I'm sorry, Peter.
Yeah. Are you ready to Yogi Bear and Boo Boo?
It's all just so sad. And Simon Pegg's speech at the end I thought was very sad about that whole notion of being lied to and how shitty his life turned out. I thought it was really sad and came from an honest place and wasn't just trying to redeem this loser.
And I think there are lots of people who feel that way for whatever reason.
Yeah.
Which might explain why this country consumes so much alcohol. If we're so free and happy, why are so many people interested in anesthetizing themselves? Speaking of which, check out my new column, September 3rd, Drunk on Foolish Pleasures.
Oh, are we just plugging columns now?
Yep.
Because I got to talk about something. All right, so this movie's a lot about nostalgia, too.
Yeah, definitely.
And it's been kind of a recurring theme, and recently on the website, or actually just for a long time on the website, about how we do, like, physical media, and we like things that are nostalgic, and we often like to go back and look at stuff and see how it measures up to our memory of it. So this week I'm writing a column about, I did an experiment where I went to video stores for 30 days and I didn't rent anything off Netflix. I didn't go to Redbox. I just went back to video stores, and it made me less nostalgic than I've ever been in my entire life. It made me like King Progress, where I'm just like, I think things are going in the right direction in some cases. And that's one thing that I thought is kind of interesting to tie in with The World's End is, it sort of shows that, you know, they kind of go into it at the beginning where they're saying, you know, like, nostalgia can be really damaging and it can really set you back. But it's also kind of saying that, you know what, progress isn't all that where it's at either. So what's the answer? And the movie, I think, wisely doesn't have an answer to that. I think it's somewhere in the middle. And
because you have to give the film credit for not having these pat American movie answers. Well, the secret is a little bit of this and a little bit of this, and Gary should stop drinking.
And that's why I don't think the movie necessarily at the end, in sort of the wasteland sequence, comes down on the side of we're all better off. I think everybody's trying to find a silver lining sort of in that situation, but
and
I don't
Nick
think
Frost
it's saying.
Nick Frost does get his wife and kids back, which I thought was another great irony.
Right, and he's eating better.
And they go organic, finally.
And again, one of the things I love about Edgar Wright, and I said this at the beginning, is the way he sort of marries the thematic stuff with the things that he loves. And so even that last shot of Simon Pegg walking into the bar, and he's the king, and he's got his band of robots. And yes, on one level it works because it's about the way that Gary has changed. And he's not a new man necessarily, but he has changed through the course of what has happened. And so it works on that level, but it's also just because Edgar Wright loves Army of Darkness and Snake Plissken, and like, and you, that scene ends and you immediately think, I want to see a sequel to that. And I don't really, because that's never a good idea, but it has that great sort of, this is just the first of a chapter, you know?
And I thought it was very interesting that Simon Pegg is clean shaven at the end.
Yeah.
That did not go unnoticed.
Yeah. I really, really loved the movie. I don't even know where to rank it with the other two, only because I've only seen it once, and so I don't know.
I really liked it. I need to see it again.
Yeah.
I really like it a lot. I think there's a day, this is where it comes in, like the difference between best and favorite. Sure, and I think it's the best of the three as a movie, but I think it's probably my least favorite of the three just because it doesn't speak to me from a genre and rewatchability perspective like the other two do.
Sure.
And that's again, a tall order with
another,
those two.
Another problem is, and yeah. I'm guessing everyone listening to us have seen the first two films, the first two films set the bar.
Yeah.
I got a question for you guys. All right, so Quentin Tarantino and Edgar Wright are kind of like BFFs. They like each other a lot. Would you want to see, and which in which order, a collaboration with Tarantino and Edgar Wright, and who would you want directing and who would you want writing?
Off the top of my head, I'd say Edgar Wright writing it and Tarantino directing it.
I would almost go in reverse of that. I would say Tarantino writing, Edgar Wright directing.
Yeah. Well, it needs to happen, so I hope you guys are listening.
At least one of them has to be.
Yeah, because I'm sorry, Tarantino, I think you figured it out by now. You're so much better than Robert Rodriguez. You don't need to. You don't need to. Like,
he's the friend that he can't. Robert Rodriguez is his Gary King.
Exactly.
And Tarantino is Nick Frost.
Yeah,
like, get off my back already.
I bet you Tarantino was like telling Robert Rodriguez about Django Unchained, and he's just like, and then... You know, this happens, and then Robert Rodriguez is like, smelly cards.
Look what I'm doing in my garage.
He's like, fucking yeah, 3D, great. Bro.
I'm producing Machete Kills.
Directing Machete Kills.
Oh, my bad. I forgot.
Come on now.
Did he direct the first one?
Co-directed.
Yeah. Okay.
What do you guys
think? It
took
two people for that movie.
What do you guys think about Machete?
There's a radio commercial for The World's End.
Yeah.
With the same announcer.
That does Machete?
Right.
Really?
And...
The world's end.
Right. It's edited and it's made to sound like a 70s AIP exploitation trailer, just like Machete Kills. It's on the radio all the time.
That's very weird.
Yeah. Machete's rough. It should be fun.
I've seen that trailer dozens of times.
Yeah.
And maybe they'll regain the fun in the sequel, but I'm not counting on it.
It's weird because I thought when I saw the trailer for Machete Kills, I'm like, oh, that looks fun. But then I realized I was reacting to the song they were playing. I'm like, that song is good, but I don't think the movie looks good.
And Sofia Vergara with the gun bra. It's like, okay.
And it gets a laugh every time the trailer plays. It ends and people are laughing, and I don't understand why.
We had a gun and a belt buckle. We had a gun as a leg. Hey, Robert, here's an idea.
No, now it's on boobs.
Yeah,
look at her boobs.
That's something everyone can agree on.
Anyway, thanks for listening, everybody. Next week, of course, is our annual summer show, so make sure you listen in. This movie will probably come up again.
Excellent. I look forward to listening. I don't know if you guys are interested. I have a documentary that just came out on DVD. It originally debuted at the 2008 Cleveland Underground Film Festival.